Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And since we're talking about consumer culture and brands, it seems only appropriate to pay some attention to Sex and the City. Rob Walker is still with us. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine, and he's the author of a new book called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. And also joining Rob and me now is Dana Stevens, Slate.com's film critic. And I want to reassure all our listeners, first up, that this will be a spoiler-free discussion, which shouldn't be a problem for you, Rob, or me, since we haven't actually seen the film. But, Dana, I'm going to need you to place your hand on your Manolo Blahniks and repeat after me. I, Dana Stevens, solemnly swear that I will not reveal any plot-spoiling components of Sex and the City, and I will do my best to ensure that future viewers of this movie will not have their viewing experience spoiled by anything I may say on WNYC Today, okay?
All right, that would take the remainder of my segment to repeat that, but I do solemnly swear.
Okay, so you wrote in your review that, quote, I honestly believe that it is single-handedly responsible for a measurable uptick in the number of materialistic twits in New York City and perhaps the world.
I had a feeling you might start with that quote and maybe ask me to back it up with some evidence, which I'd probably have some trouble doing. But yeah, I think that may be a case, the you know, claim that there are more Sex and the City clones because of the show. That may be a case of mixing up the cause and the effect. Who knows whether the show was just endorsing a consumer behavior that was already there. But certainly I would think that there's been more Cosmos drunk and Manolos sold and sparkly cell phones chatted upon than before the show came along.
How far are you willing to go? Can you lay the blame for the credit crunch at the feet of Sex and the City? I
guess you know, not. It actually surprises me. The big news about Sex and the City to me, I mean, it's been so overcovered and so chewed over, and, you know, every magazine has run multiple pieces on it. The big surprise to me Monday morning was just what a huge, huge success it was. And I actually thought, coming when it did, right after the, you know, Bear Stearns meltdown and so forth, that it might be a bad moment for Sex and the City and that it might not sort of revive the TV audience that it had. But it sounds like it gained even more. It had the biggest take. What was the stat in Variety? The biggest take for romantic comedy in history, something like that, for an opening weekend. $55.7 million, I believe, which
even
I
though
found
it's
staggering.
Been getting pretty roundly panned by critics like yourself.
I guess that's true. I mean, I wouldn't really consider my review a pan. I think for critics that have a weakness for the show, as I did,
well,
a somewhat ambivalent weakness for
it. Your review, as I read it, was, I don't really care if this is a bad movie. I'm just nostalgic for this character, and I want to see what happened to them.
Well, I was trying to give voice in my review, as I think a few other critics did. It wasn't so roundly panned, I wouldn't say. I think that a few other critics I can think of, you know, gave voice to their own pleasure in the show without necessarily, you know, making it an argument for the show or the movie.
I want to update listeners on the Clinton story that we gave a few minutes earlier from the Associated Press and update it with a denial and a refutation of the accuracy of this story. What we had reported, in case you weren't listening, from the Associated Press, the AP is reporting that Senator Clinton will concede tonight that Barack Obama has the delegates to secure the Democratic nomination. The story cited two senior Clinton campaign officials. It said that she will stop short of formally suspending or ending her race when she speaks in New York tonight after the polls close in Montana and South Dakota. She will pledge to continue to speak out on issues like health care, but that most campaign staff would be let go and paid only through June 15th, according to the officials quoted by the Associated Press, but that she would concede that Barack Obama has the delegates to secure the Democratic nomination. So the Clinton campaign has immediately responded to this AP story and put out a statement that it is incorrect, that Senator Clinton will not concede the nomination this evening. Senator Clinton will not concede the nomination this evening. Now, reading not between the lines, but reading very closely to the actual in the actual wording of the AP story, it's kind of actually confusing what these campaign officials reportedly said that she would do, because they said that she would concede that Obama has the delegates to secure the nomination, but she would not formally suspend the campaign or end her campaign. So, you know, if she were to do something like that, it would be confusing to begin with, because she would concede that he has the delegates to win the nomination, but she would be continuing her race. So the whole premise of it sort of didn't make sense in the first place. And now the Clinton campaign says the AP story is incorrect. Senator Clinton will not concede the nomination this evening. She'll do something. And Obama will do something. And we'll find out exactly what it is after these final votes when we bring you those speeches live with analysis when they happen tonight here on WNYC. But I definitely wanted to clarify that AP story with the rebuttal from the Clinton campaign. All right. And we'll talk about this again with a guest, Ben Smith from Politico, when we're done with this, coming up in a few minutes. So more on that to come. But, all right, back to Sex and the City and Consumed and the secret relationship that we have with the things that we buy. Rob Walker, were you surprised to see the New York Times business page take Sex and the City as seriously as it does? It seemed like people are coming close to asking the question, will this movie pull us out of the credit crunch?
Yeah, I was surprised to see, not any particular, but just not just that story, but I felt like that question was being asked all over the place. Like, will this have an impact on retail sales? And how much of an impact will it be? And like, oh, people are a little disappointed that maybe there won't be quite as much an uptick as a result of this movie. It's kind of a startling thing, and to me just shows, I guess, that, you know, again, we just take this this stuff all for granted, the interweaving of branding, entertainment, and the economy, and doesn't seem to be anywhere, you know, just seems like legitimate fodder to discuss. And, you know, I just wanted to follow up on one thing about the number of Cosmos it sold and stuff like that. It's a classic example of people, if you ask people, is your behavior, your shopping behavior affected by things you see celebrities wear, they'll all say no. But the, you know, the proof is in the sales. The proof is in the Cosmo.
And Dana, you write in your review that these characters' faith in labels will never budge. No real-life relationship Carrie and her cohorts reluctantly concede can live up to the impossible expectations our culture places on romantic love. But luxury commodities, those are more than capable of fulfilling every fantasy. The right Louis Vuitton bag, am I saying it right?
Louis Vuitton?
Louis Vuitton bag can, the right Louis Vuitton bag can change your life.
Yeah, this is the strange paradox at the heart of the movie, which, you know, you have to have a big tolerance for paradox to get through something like this, but it's all about labels and love, right? The movie opens and closes, and this is not spoiling a thing, with this affirmation that New York City women want two things. They come to New York for two things, labels and love, and never sort of gets at the truth that, you know, well, we would hope in life that one of those things would, you know, be a little bit more lasting and meaningful than the other.
Roslyn in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Roslyn.
Hey, how are you?
All right.
You basically reiterated my point. I think the reason the show is so successful, and I've thought about this a lot because I play a character in a downtown show that is a Sex and the City-aholic. I think, you know, it's glamorizing. The show kind of glamorizes what we think is trite or materialistic, but stuff happens to those women while they're wearing Manolos, while they're at Asia Day Cuba. Amazing life things happen, and I think that's why so many Manhattan women are like, I've got to have the Manolos, I've got to have the Cosmo, because then I'll get the man, then I'll get the boyfriend. And I think, you know, I think that's why it's so attractive. I think that's why you have so many nitwits running around thinking that they need that, because if I get these material things, then I will get this life fulfillment.
It wasn't nitwit. Get the quote right. It was materialistic twits.
Sorry, materialistic twits.
Dana, what do you think about Roslyn's theory?
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about Rob's concept of marketing that you were talking about. I mean, there's nothing murky about the way Manolo Blahnik, for example, are marketed on the show. I have no idea if there's any relationship between, you know, the company and the show.
Well, is it product placement? Because wasn't it your review that mentioned the raft of product placements? Or maybe it was another review that I read.
I don't think I mentioned product placement. I mean, it's definitely there. But, I mean, in most movies, you know, you can count yourself as a little bit clever when you notice the product placements. You know, oh, they're drinking from a certain kind of soda can, you know, or there's something in the background. But, you know, both throughout the TV show and the movie, I don't think there's ever been a brand name that's been as associated with a television show that I can think of as Manolo Blahnik and Sex and the City.
Rob, anything on this? I noticed that Sex and the City does not come up in the index of your book. I admit to not having read every word in the book. I noticed that you mentioned Dorothy Parker, but not Sarah Jessica Parker.
Well, what I would say about Sex and the City and the way that they use brands on the show, it's interesting that I have no idea what their sort of product placement deals are or are not, but, you know, it's kind of inconceivable that they could do a show like this without, you know, the brands and the right brands and all of that. And as a character development thing, it kind of almost makes sense because brands are, for better or for worse, this shorthand that pretty much everybody gets. If you named, you know, if you said, let's define Sarah Jessica Parker's character by naming her favorite novel, how much would that resonate with everybody in the audience? But if you say, well, Louis Vuitton, people pretty much get, like, right there, you have a nice snapshot of, okay, I know where you're going with this person.
Dana, you know, it's easy to get women, you've probably been involved in these discussions, to start debating about whether Sex and the City has been good for women, you know, whether it has these reprehensible values that kind of channel people into materialistic lifestyle and not to mention dysfunctional relationships, or whether it has reinforced the values of independence and talking frankly with your friends about sex and other things and, you know, kind of been good for women in some global abstract sense. Do you have an opinion about that?
That's a great question. That's sort of the question. Actually, we did have a discussion on Slate about this. In addition to my review, we published a discussion among four women, including me, some haters of the show, some who barely knew the show, and, you know, essentially talked about that. Is Sex and the City feminist? You know, how do you sort of react to it as a woman writer in particular? And I don't know. I guess the answer to is it a feminist show would have to be, I don't think it either advances or retards the cause of feminism, which I guess would mean that it's not feminist. But I think that there is something... there's something that I really like about the conception of female friendship in the show and in the movie. And I think that it is a real site of pleasure for women. So, you know, in that sense, maybe it is good for them.
And
I mean, $55 million worth of pleasure this past weekend. Obviously, it speaks to a lot of people and not just because of the branding, I don't think.
Lorraine in Bloomfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lorraine.
Hello.
Hello.
In Hillsdale.
I'm sorry.
No problem. For years, I've been bugged. Why do women buy clothes or anything with somebody's name on it? You are advertising for them and not getting paid for it. I mean, I think that's the most ridiculous thing.
Is this a generational thing, Dana? Do you think that I'm guessing by people's voices and appearances here, but do you think that Lorraine's generation and your generation just have a different relationship with brands?
I don't know. I have no idea of the distance between our generations. But when you, Brian, were saying earlier that you refuse to wear logos, my boyfriend, who I think is probably not quite a generation, but a bit younger than you, is the same way. Cuts them out of his clothes if necessary, will not wear them. But I think when you get to kids a little bit younger than that, people that, you know, really did grow up with universal branding and logos everywhere, I doubt that that's trickled down too far.
Rob, generational thing?
I think to some extent it probably is, not so much that the generations are different, but that the context is different, you know, as time goes. But just if you're, the younger you are, the larger portion of your life has been that much more brand soaked. And I just think that at a certain point, as I was saying with the, you know, there's the immediate understanding it's the last language that we all speak in the same tongue that everyone gets. And it's difficult to ignore. And it's taken as a normal thing, I think.
So, Dana, before you go, one of my producers has a male friend who doesn't understand why men don't want to see the movie. And apparently men don't want to see the movie. Four good-looking women, a near guarantee of nudity and sex. What's not to like? He says if they were really smart, they would market the film to men by calling it the film your wife doesn't want you to see.
I would love to see, actually, we did the discussion among four women. I'd love to see four men get together, four straight men, and dish about why they don't want to see Sex in the City, if they don't, or maybe they secretly do.
I thought that's what Ally McBeal was about, you know? There was a show that was purportedly about the independent woman lawyer also navigating her relationships, but really it was eye candy for men.
I guess so. But were they really the audience for it? I have no idea. I mean, I guess what amazes me is that enough women managed to get a bunch of posse of women or drag their men to get a lot of people to see the movie. It must have been, you know, a huge portion of the audience must have been female if men weren't seeing it.
I think Ally McBeal had a higher proportion of men watching than Sex and the City did, so something changed. All right, Dana Stevens from Slate.com, Rob Walker, who writes the Consume column for the New York Times Magazine and has a brand new book called Buying In. Thank you both.
Happy to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, we will figure out what's going on with the Clinton and Obama campaigns, and we will look for your inner Christopher Carter. And if you don't know who he is, stay tuned.